broadcasting from the UNMC College of Nursing. Get ready for RN Huddle, the podcast dedicated to bringing hot topics for and by nurses to the table.
Welcome to today's podcast. This will be an interesting conversation for most of you because I hear a lot from you about medical devices leading to pressure injuries, particularly oxygen delivery devices. And my guests happen to be experts in that topic. So we're going to get to them in just a second. As you know, if you've been listening to these, I start with what's in my mailbox. So let me tell you what's in my mailbox. Well, let me tell you, it's repeatedly in my mailbox. So let me tackle this question. How do I know the difference between a stage two and a stage three pressure injury? Because it doesn't seem to be as easy as the pictures or the diagrams. Well, you're absolutely correct. We think of stage two pressure injuries as being fairly shallow and heal rapidly just through simple epithelialization. Don't leave a scar even, because the epithelium doesn't leave a scar. And stage three, okay, maybe being deeper, that's kind of the way we look at it. Heal by granulation tissue, yes, leave a scar. I can tell you it's not that simple. Sounds really simple. It's not that simple. And right now we don't have good diagnostics. So it's simply how you look at them. I can tell you that NPIAP is working on some different ways to differentiate the base of the ulcer. So please bear with us as we work that out. We will have some educational material coming your way. I appreciate that the diagrams don't quite help you as much as they can or should or maybe could. So be patient. We'll get to those. So let me introduce my guests to you today. We have two respiratory therapists, and I think the conversation is going to be very informative to you. I'll let them introduce themselves to you. Just let me introduce them briefly. We have Lexi Caraway and Denise Lauterbach, both are respiratory therapists. So Lexi, could you introduce yourself to the group and then just turn the mic over to Denise when you're done?
Sure. I'm Lexi Caraway. I've been a respiratory therapist about 13 years, and I'm very interested in preventing pressure injuries. I'm the current manager of Clay County Hospital in Flora, Illinois.
Hi, my name is Denise Lauterbaugh, and I am a respiratory therapist. I previously worked with the Solutions for Patient Safety Data Coalition in preventing respiratory device-related pressure injuries, and I'm currently a travel respiratory therapist as I'm going through school to get my doctorate in public health.
So you ladies have seen a fair number of not only the devices used to maintain oxygenation and ventilation, but some of the things that I see as a wound nurse. Oxygen delivery systems are probably the most commonly reported medical device pressure-related injury that we see, even in national numbers. And Denise, you've probably seen those numbers with some of the work that you're doing. What drives those numbers? What makes those numbers so high?
So first, I'll just approach the actual percentage of the numbers, because they're about 68% of device-related pressure injuries are associated with respiratory devices. So that is huge. And about 20% of them are leaked to either bilevel positive airway pressure or continuous positive airway pressure. So for those of you that don't understand or recognize those words, that's BiPAP and CPAP, and those are sleep masks. Even in pediatric population, we see that about 28% of the pressure injuries are associated with those same devices. So many of these injuries occur in the ICU, which could make you think about the idea that maybe some poor mobility on the patient's part, some poor sensory perception, so not knowing to move the mask when it's feeling painful, poor nutrition, poor perfusion, tissue oxygenation, a higher metabolic needs and rate, edema, and a higher number of medical devices on the patient can be associated with those intensive care unit stays and maybe a reason why we're seeing those sleep device injuries in the ICU when we don't see as many in the acute care units. In premature infants, we see it more because of underdeveloped subcutaneous fat tissue and immature cohesion of the epidermis and the dermis. The Neonates also have physiological changes over time. So where it may not be a problem at one point, it might be a problem at another point. They have a loss of surface temperature and, of course, increased risk of skin trauma because their skin is so sensitive. So that puts them at significant risk. The most common areas that I see pressure injuries in with the sleep masks are the face and the ears, especially at the bridge of the nose. I have seen with patients who they're trying to put an oral gastric or a nasal gastric tube in with the sleep mask, that you'll have increased pressure at the area around that area. So that can also cause it. And then moisture and pH of the skin. That's from Geffen et al. 2020. They noticed that that also affects sleep masks and the tolerance of the skin.
And I will echo Denise there with when we were doing our study, the hospital I used to work at, I was approached when our medical device related pressure injuries were at 27%. And all of that was caused by BiPAP or CPAP masks at that time. So that's really when I was approached by our wound care team and also administration and said, we need to get this under control. In addition to BiPAP and CPAP masks, we all need to be aware, and this is definitely a learning curve for respiratory therapists to keep an eye on other devices we use. For example, nasal cannulas, endotracheal tube holders, again, non-invasive masks, so our CPAP and BiPAP masks, and also PEP therapy, which is positive expiratory pressure therapies we use sometimes on patients to help with atelectasis and different lung issues they might be having. We do hold those masks on to their face, usually with a little bit of pressure. So we really need to keep an eye on how we're doing that. And also our tubings, our ventilator tubing, our BiPAP tubing that can sometimes get under an arm of a patient or not where they should be hanging. Keeping an eye on those delivery devices, pulse ox probes, and this isn't really related to oxygen, but it is related to respiratory, our high frequency chest wall oscillation vests. Sometimes they get left under patients, and that is definitely a cause for concern.
So what I've seen in clinical practice is that there's, I'm not a respiratory therapist, so I'll be the first person to say that. There's almost a hypervigilance to get the pressure delivery really, really high with no leaks in the mask. And therefore the mask has to be secured extremely tightly. The straps are tight, well, either going across the cheek or atop, on top of the head. Is my perception correct? Does the pressure have to be that high that there's no leak? If there's a leak, the mask is not functional, the pressures are not helpful. Help me understand that, because it seems like that's kind of a constant battle. If I turn the patient's body and I turn the head, all of a sudden there's a leak and then the story's over.
So I think I'd like to address this first, if Lexi doesn't mind. I actually did a research study on this, and we found that putting the mask on too tight can actually lead to pressure injuries, and that leaving it too loose can lead to pressure injuries. So there is a specific amount of leak in between too tight and too loose, which is 25 to 55 liters per minute of a leak. So previously, we all tried to get those masks on as tight as possible and to get them to reach their pressures. But now we're trying to target allowing there to be a little bit of a leak as long as the mask has not moved off to one side. So like you said, when you repositioned a patient to the one side, you might need to loosen the straps, reposition so that it's securely on, but giving equal pressure to all parts of the skin, and then resecure the straps. If it's positioned off to the side, it's probably putting too much pressure on one part of the skin and it's too loose on the other. So the position where it's too tight on the skin can cause a pressure injury, and the other side can have friction and shear and also moisture, which can cause a pressure injury. So you can get it on both sides. So really the most important part of putting your mask on your patient is ensuring that it's secured with even distribution.
Like to add to that, the facial structure of the patient really needs to be taken into consideration whenever we are placing masks on patients. A lot of times the patient will complain of a leak in the eye, which obviously we don't want it to bother the patient. But I think as respiratory therapists, sometimes we understand that a small to moderate leak is acceptable, but I don't know that everyone on the care team is always aware of that. So it's really important to do proper education with the sitters in the room, the patient's families in the room, the patient themselves, and the nursing staff, just to make sure that everybody understands, as long as there's not like shear friction or a huge leak, that leaks are acceptable.
So what's your best advice to those listening about how respiratory therapy and nurses can work together? And I think the example you're just giving is a good one, although I can't envision in my own mind that every time I turn the patient, I'm going to have respiratory therapy there to help me readjust the mask. But, you know, not just with the masks, not the BiPAP CPAP masks, but as you were saying a minute ago, the endotracheal tube is another one. The trach straps, the trach flange, the trach ties. How can we work together as a team to reduce what I would call all of that? I would bundle all of that in the oxygen delivery system bundle of medical device pressure injury. We've got to find a way to work together on that. What's your advice on that?
Well, I would say for us, whenever we first started reviewing our protocol and our processes, we took a look at the NPI guidelines and specifically 8.3 to assess the skin under and around medical devices for signs of pressure-related injury as part of a routine skin assessment. So what we did with that was we just included in our protocol that the nurse and the respiratory therapist, once per shift, would go in together and assess the patient's skin, kind of talk about it, see how everything's going, and then make recommendations from there and just work on it together.
So when the perhaps at the beginning of the shift would be your recommendation, because skin assessment's done then. So when the RT came by to do their initial assessment of all of the equipment, that would be the logical time for you to do all of that assessment. Seems logical to me to do that.
Generally first, like when you first receive a patient, just like nursing, we would go in and do our first ventilator check or our first BiPAP check or early in the shift. One other thing that we noticed that really helped us is we improved the respiratory therapy documentation so that we could actually like chart a little bit more in depth about what we were seeing on the face. And we just really learned to help each other on this problem.
When you carried out that program, Lexi, what were your findings? Did you find obviously greater collaboration, but did you see a reduction in medical device injury from oxygen delivery systems with that teamwork process?
We did actually. We had a really, this was a huge project. We did a lot of different things from the way that we stock supplies on our devices. We felt it was just low hanging fruit. Giving bordered and non-bordered foam, barrier wipes stocked on the equipment. So there was really no excuse to not be trying to prevent pressure injuries from the moment they went on a device. But we wound up discovering something in the process of working on preventing these pressure injuries. And that was using thermographic imaging to detect them present on admission. But we had five medical device related pressure injuries in 1 year. And then following year, we had zero by implementing all of these processes.
Well, that's 100% reduction in pressure injuries. So that's pretty dang good. I don't think you could get any better than that. I specifically wanted to ask you the question, though, about, and this is a conversation that Lexi and I had a few months back. There are a number of people today that are at home on CPAP or BiPAP, maybe sleep with it, maybe put it on due to increasing respiratory difficulty and sit in their recliner for a couple days, hoping they'll get better, and then don't get better and come in. And Lexi, I really want you to explain to the audience what you did, being aware of a longer period of time with CPAP and BiPAP on, and how to assess the quality and the condition of their skin on admission. Because to be honest, I had never thought about it. So I do want you to talk about, you briefly mentioned it, but I want you to go into a little more detail if you would.
Sure. We this honestly just kind of fell into our lap. We had some really great respiratory therapists that suggested this. Our hospital had been using thermographic imaging for a little over a year before we stumbled upon this, but at admission, all patients were imaged if they went to ICU, if they were admitted with a fall, if they'd had a surgical procedure lasting a certain amount of time, if they came in from a nursing home, all of these different reasons to take pictures of their heels and their coccyx. So when we were working so hard to prevent these pressure injuries, we had this particular patient came in and got placed on BiPAP in the emergency room. And when they moved the patient to ICU, then she required the photos to be taken. And the respiratory therapist was in the room and just kind of suggested they take a picture of the face because we had been working on this and it was just an idea. And after the picture was viewed and after the wound care nurse took a look at it, they were like, she had a pressure injury that was already existing before she came in. And so then that was kind of our aha moment that these patients who wear BiPAPs or CPAPs at home, when they're feeling like they're probably getting a little sick and they ultimately know that they're going to wind up coming to the emergency room and getting placed on BiPAP or CPAP, they're probably wearing an additional time at home to try to prevent it themselves. So we just began screening the patients a little bit differently and really worked to capture anyone who was placed on BiPAP in the emergency room and also wears a non-invasive mask at home. We took their picture.
I think that's amazing. So those of you that are listening, the thermographic device is a camera that picks up areas of ischemia in tissue as well as areas of inflammation in tissue. So the camera would depict areas of high pressure from the mask, and those areas would turn blue or purple, and it would also pick up areas of inflammation in the tissue, and those areas would turn red or orange. The government has already determined that that camera does allow you to claim that these were present on admission. So one of the things to me that's extremely difficult with pressure injuries of the face is the patient, because we've had, of course, over the years, patients who develop pressure injuries on the face from any number of things, including oxygen delivery systems. And the lawyers for the hospital tell us, how are we going to defend this? You know, the patient came in for elective surgery and left with pressure injuries on the face. That was not where the operation was. So they pay them. They can't figure out how to defend them. And that's kind of what we're talking about is pressure injuries on the face. You can't put a bag over your head as you leave the hospital so nobody can see it. Where in contrast, pressure injuries on the sacrum or the heels, unless you take your clothing off, no one knows you have that. Pressure injuries on the face are a different story. So one of the things that Lexi and I've been talking about, Denise, you and I have not had an opportunity to talk about this, is what's the role of the stiffness of the plastic of the device? And some of the work that Dr. Geffen did, and Denise, I recognize you referenced him a while ago. Dr. Geffen did some studies on the stiffness of the plastic of the medical devices. Do you think there's an opportunity for us to work with the manufacturers of the devices? This is particularly oxygen delivery devices, particularly the nasal cannula, perhaps the endotracheal tube itself, more so than the BiPAP and CPAP at least have a facial pad that's not as stiff. But where do you think our future is in working with manufacturing to reduce the stiffness of the plastic? Do we have any hope here at all? What do you guys think?
I think that there's some manufacturers who are already making less stiff nasal cannulas. Those tend to be more expensive, so the hospital doesn't tend to buy them, but they are available. Endotracheal tubes would be more difficult because we already have patients who have teeth that can bite through their endotracheal tube, who can bend the endotracheal tube with their teeth. So the stiffness of the endotracheal tube is actually a little bit important. And a lot of times, especially in adult care, we use bite blocks in their mouth to prevent them from biting through the endotracheal tube, which those are even harder plastic. I tend to see more pressure injuries with the bite blocks than I do with the endotracheal tube itself, because they're larger and they have edges that probably should be smoothed out more. They tend to be a little bit on the, they're not necessarily sharp, but they're not smooth. So I think we can work with companies on those bite blocks, but I think the airway tubes have to be harder. Now, nasal trumpets and those type of things are already soft, and we haven't mentioned those before. I never really see pressure injuries with a nasal trumpet unless someone's tried to put an NG tube in the same nair.
Lexi, what's your thought? Have we got any hope to work with manufacturing to take away some of the risk from the stiffness of the plastic?
I would think so. It's such a big problem, and it's such a costly problem for hospitals. And obviously, patients, their faces can be completely deformed if they have a bad pressure injury. So it's really something just everyone needs to be looking at. But whenever companies do try to, you know, work on this problem, it would be nice if they engaged respiratory therapists too, to try to help give their input on the problem.
Absolutely. My son happens to be a craniofacial surgeon, and he talks about the deformity in the face in neonates that he has to correct later on from oxygen delivery systems. Recognizing, you know, airway breathing are crucial to life, but isn't there a way to deliver that oxygen in a safer way to avoid permanent deformity to the face in everyone, but of course the neonate in particular? Well, we're getting near the end of our time for this podcast. I want to thank my guests today. Wonderful conversation about a very serious topic. We could probably talk for an hour, and we should have you present at one of our programs to really give the audience a chance to talk with you. Any final comments before we close? The question at hand is, how do we reduce the risk of pressure injuries from oxygen delivery systems? What's the relationship of the device respiratory therapy and the nurses at the bedside? Any final comments from Denise or Lexi before I close this off and say thank you once again?
I'd just like to make a comment coming from a pediatric and neonatal side of things, that the assessment of the skin has to happen more often in neonates and pediatrics. They get pressure injuries very quickly, as your son can probably attest to. And so we need to check and we need to rotate devices on those patients so that this pressure is not in the same area. So whether it's rotating from different size masks or from mask to prongs, or moving the cannula to a different secure position, those things need to happen more frequently.
And to that, I would just add, you know, getting respiratory therapists involved in preventing the pressure injuries a little bit more, providing them education. I really didn't think this was, Joyce knows, I didn't really think this was our problem when our wound care nurses approached me. But I did learn it is our problem, and we can do a lot to help that. So allow your respiratory therapist to give feedback on ideas and help write the policy. And I think that they'll show great ownership, and there's a lot to be learned from respiratory with pressure injuries.
Well, let me thank our guests. You have heard from two of the most well-versed and well-studied respiratory therapists that I could have chosen to do this podcast. Thank you for your expertise. Thank you for your advice. I hope those who are listening can take this back to work in about 5 minutes and change the outcome of people that have current use of oxygen delivery systems. Let me thank Courtney Smith, the executrix, as I think the word is, for podcasting here at the University of Nebraska as part of the RN Huddle. This will be posted on RN Huddle and, as you know, on the NPIEP podcast site. Let's sign off, and I'll see you next time. Thank you much.
Thank you for listening to RN Huddle. To stay connected, follow us on Twitter and Facebook at UNMCCNE or check out unmc.edu/CNE for more program information.